Hey guys, thanks for tuning us in for this 23rd episode of Good Questions with Cameron Dole. In this episode, special guests include Melora Hardin. Also, we'll be talking with musician Maudy, Dan Wasserbly, the author of The 300, also lead singer of Striper Michael Sweet, and best-selling author Rachel Hollis. If you would, please take the time to subscribe, drop a like, comment, leave some feedback, share with your friends, and rate the podcast, please, if you would. Up first is actress and producer now, Melora Hardin, from the new series on Freeform, The Bold Type. Melora, good to visit with you this morning.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
Now, how are you looking forward in great anticipation? Are you a little butterflies as the directorial debut for you? What's the feelings coming into tomorrow night's episode?
I feel excited and great about it. I mean, obviously, I've been with the episode since the beginning, and sat in the editing room and got it shaped up to something I feel really proud about. And I love the show, and the show's lots of fun, and so this was a particularly fun episode where I think people will see even some strange analogies or even alignments with what we've all been going through with the pandemic, and I think that's kind of interesting. Everybody gets kind of stuck and has to connect and has to, relate to people that they may or may not want to be spending time with, and that's, I think that's something that the whole world's been going through lately.
Now, for you, as a directorial debut, is whenever you first got behind the screen or behind the scenes for you, what was the first opportunity to lend your analysis to? What was that like for you?
I don't know. I loved it. I've loved, everything I've directed. I've really, really enjoyed the process of that. And I was told by a producer that I worked with when I was in my 20s that I should really direct because I have that, I guess he called it, unique quality of the iron fist and the velvet glove. And then my husband wrote a really beautiful screenplay called You, and I just sort of felt compelled. I felt like the screenplay itself was kind of a love letter to me, and I think that the movie was a love letter back to him. And I just felt like I had to tell that story. It was sort of semi-autobiographical with some fictitious, elements added in. And I just felt like I understood the story and I understood the love that he's talking about in the film. And it's a beautiful love story. And then ultimately I feel like that kind of ended up being my film school as a director. And then I just went on to direct quite a few other things. It just felt natural and was something that I was pursuing. And then as far as with The Bold Type, I let the producers know when they offered me the part of Jacqueline Carlisle very early on that I wanted to direct and that I was directing. And they sort of said, yeah, great. Well, in success, we'll do it. We'll do it. And so I was really excited when the Snow Day episode came my way.
Now, you've been working on other things as well, obviously got a recurring role on A Million Little Things, and obviously everything has slowed down a little bit now. What is the thing that you anticipate the most as things start to open up a little bit?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what I anticipate the most. I certainly am looking forward to getting back to work on both The Bold Type and A Million Little Things, and I think we all get a little, I don't know, I feel sometimes a little like stir crazy, but I feel really grateful that I have, my documentary that I've been working on for 4 years and I'm still working hard on that. And that's a really great creative outlet. And also we filmed The Bold Type in Montreal. So it's been a wonderful family time for me to be here in LA with my two daughters and my husband and my dog and my cat and kind of staying put for a little bit of time has been refreshing in some ways as well, not to be running around back and forth and back and forth.
Now, you talked about the documentary, and this is timely as well, and has this allowed you maybe a little bit more time to be introspective about the documentary you were talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I was already pretty deep into it. I mean, as I said, I've been working on it for 4 years. But to have sort of like very quiet time where there's really nothing pulling at you in any direction except, you know, just sort of putting some hours every day towards the sort of finessing and the shaping and the sculpting of this beautiful story has been a wonderful, wonderful gift for me and for the film, for sure.
And again, the new episode, Snow Day, on the Bold Type Freeform tomorrow night, 10 Eastern, 9 local time. And Melora, always want to make sure and let our listeners know where they can keep up with everything you've got going on social media-wise as well.
Yeah, thanks. They can follow me on Instagram at Melora D. Harden, and they can follow me on Twitter at Melora Harden.
All right. Well, Melora, it's been great to visit with you this morning. Looking forward to the release of that documentary. We'll keep our eyes and ears open for that. And also catching you on a million things and The Bold Type. Hope you have a great rest of your week.
Thank you so much. Have a great one.
Up next, we talk with author Dan Wasserbly, talking about the book The 300, the story of missile defenders guarding us from nuclear attack. First off, Daniel, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Now, being a military town, Altus Air Force Base here, obviously we know a little bit about what the military capabilities are, but how blown away are you by the work that the Missile Defense Program puts in protecting Americans every day?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting story, and I was very, very surprised in a good way to have met the soldiers who operate the system. Really, I think on the worst day imaginable, if nuclear warheads are flying at the United States, most Americans would expect that, of course, they'd be shot down. But really, only recently did this become even a possibility. And it's really, really difficult to do. So it was very interesting to meet the soldiers who actually do this job.
And the technology that it takes to even think about these kind of things, how old did it make you feel having to see the technology that is actually out there?
Yeah, it's been a long time coming. You can trace it all the way back to the 1940s and 1950s if you really wanted to go to the earliest days of it. In the late 90s, it sort of took off. It had a very rough couple of years in the beginning with some reliability problems because they were trying to do something really, really astronomically difficult. But in the last couple of years, it's been trending in the right direction, and they've had a lot more success.
So to see this put into book form for you, how hard is it to put it in layman's terms to not get too wordy, if you will, to put it over our heads to get the information across?
It's always a challenge. I get benefit from my background writing about this stuff for my day job. But it is in many cases very literally astrophysics. It has to be explained to me in a way that I can understand it, because I'm certainly not a physicist. And I have to explain it in a way that someone who doesn't follow this sort of thing can understand it. So it's difficult. It was much easier done because I try to do as much as humanly possible through the eyes of the soldiers who operate the system. And although most of them are much smarter than I am, of course, on how it works, they're good at explaining it from a human perspective.
And to see them work, how much pride do you take being able to tell their story and maybe give them the props that otherwise they may not see anywhere else?
That was a really nice, unexpected part of what was normally, I guess, because we're talking about nuclear warfare, right, which can be a really heavy and super depressing subject. And it really put a nice shine on it for me to meet the men and women who do this and to hear from them. See how interesting and hear their really amazing stories that some of them have for what it took for them to work their way up into this sort of elite job and what it took for them to establish a military unit that does something as really heavy as this that didn't even exist 20 years ago. So, yeah, it was great.
And to be able to put a face and a name, obviously, in media and in coverage, a lot of times you just get to tell the story or tell a bit of the story. To be able to see them firsthand, to bring humanity to what seems inhuman or all technology side of the story.
Yeah, and that's a great point, because a lot of the times when this gets discussed, We talk about the money that goes into the development, or we talk about the hardware and whether the politics of it makes sense or not. But a very undertold version of it is who actually does this very, very difficult mission that requires significant commitment. And so it was really neat to meet the men and women who sit there for 12-hour shifts in a windowless control node monitoring for Armageddon, right? It was really impressive. I'm glad I was able to tell it through their eyes as opposed to telling it like an engineer.
Now, what was the biggest surprise, maybe the biggest aha moment during the research and in the face-to-face visits?
I guess it was learning more about what it's like to live in subarctic Alaska, because most of the soldiers in this unit and then the actual interceptor missiles themselves are in Fort Greely, Alaska, which is a very beautiful at times, but also a very dangerous and challenging place to operate. I mean, there's like a whole part of the year where the sun just barely peaks above the horizon for a couple minutes. And sometimes it's sunny every day, all day. It's a wild place with bears and moose, dangers everywhere you look. But they love it. And then a lot of them retire there, just their kind of place. And it was really neat to see how humans who are from Florida or Puerto Rico go up there and adapt so well and really actually enjoy living there.
And again, the book, The 300, The Inside Story of the Missile Defenders Guarding America Against Nuclear Attack, available tomorrow, is available. And Dana, I always want to make sure and let our listeners know where they can keep up with more information about the book and everything else you've got going on as well.
Yeah, so I am certainly happy to answer any questions or take any fun feedback. Or you can follow me on Twitter at UNOPERIODICO, Uno Periodico, follow the book. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, or at your independent bookseller.
All right. Well, Daniel, again, thank you for your time. Looking forward to spending some more time with the book as well.
All right. Thank you so much.
Again, check out that book, The 300, Story of Missile Defenders Guarding Us from Nuclear Attack, by Dan Wasserblade. All right, guys, our next guest is local here in Altus, Oklahoma, and has a single that we've been playing at the radio station for a while, and texted him a couple weeks ago. We've been texting back and forth, been good friends for a while, and I said, you know, we got to get you on the podcast, and we finally worked it out, and he's on with us today. I call him a friend, and has the new single. Actually, it's been out for a little bit. Painting Stars, Maudie is with us. And first off, thanks for joining us.
Hey, absolutely. I'm happy to be here.
Now the thing, I remember whenever you approached me at church and you were like, hey, actually, I think I approached you. You didn't even approach me about the single. But I heard that you were releasing the single. And what was your thought when the listenership on the single kind of first picked up? What was the thoughts with that?
Well, it was kind of wild for me because I've been making music for like a year now and it never got that kind of attention. So to look down one day and, you know, I had that kind of listenership. Is that the word for it?
Listenership. Yeah, something like that.
It kind of struck me different. It was weird. It was a real wow factor, nothing I'd experienced before.
And then, so you had the ups, and then you start seeing it taper off a little bit. But having the first ups, that's got to be it's got to be a little rewarding, right?
Yeah, for me to see, you know, something I'd been working on. You know, I put my heart into it. So to see that flourish and see it have a little bit of success, it was more than worth it.
Now, the process for you, you talk about doing, and I know you do all the instruments, you do all the music, everything is yours, the writing and all that. Where's the process? Do you start with a tune? Do you start with that? Is that what inspires you? Or do you start with the lyrics? Where does the music first come from for you?
Well, for this song, I was just kind of scrolling through Instagram, and I'm always listening to like videos and stuff, and I'd hear, you know, a couple different melodies on different songs and stuff, and the melodies themselves kind of fade away, but the idea of the music stays in my head. And so when I sit down to start writing, I try to make a endpoint. So I start with the endpoint. I give myself somewhere to stop at, And once I find that point, that's where I start writing words. And when I start writing words, I build the music with it. It's kind of probably different than most people do. They probably, you know, write the words, make the track, you're done. But I kind of write the music and the words as I go because I like to put the feelings in order.
Mm-hmm. Now, where did you've been working on music? I know for, like you said, about a year. Where did the first inspiration for music happen in your life?
Well, I mean, I've been doing music stuff since I was probably 8 or 9. I started taking guitar lessons when I was like 8 years old. They didn't work out. They didn't last long. I think the guitar instructor got a little tired of me. I wasn't too good. But as time went on, I started playing more. I got more interested in it. My family members had been in bands, so I joined band. I started learning more and more guitar. And then as soon as I hit about 6th grade, I think I was, I don't even know how old I was, I got asked to join the worship band at church. And so that's where I started getting really into music. I learned everything I could. I did everything I could. And since then, I've just been going and going.
Now, what is the music that that's on your playlist? What's your playlist made of?
Oh, you'd be surprised. So, Painting Stars is more of a, you know, EDM pop type song. But my playlist, I have probably 6 hours worth of music that I listen to daily. It goes from rap to pop to country, surprisingly. You know, I'm not a fan of country.
I know, that is a bit of a surprise.
I'm not a big fan of country, but there's some songs that hit me right. Just everything that kind of goes into it. I mean, I like to diversify. Mm-hmm. So if I'm just listening to the radio, which isn't often, if a song hits me right, I download it. If I'm just scrolling through Instagram, a song hops on, hits me right, I download it. You know, it's just whatever makes me feel good.
Now, when you're getting ready to go to work, do you go like Metallica mode, or do you go like 70s, like light pop? Is that what's the playlist as you prepare for work?
I don't really. Well, I mean, I guess it changes by my mood that day. Yeah. So if I'm in a really good mood and I want it to keep going, I'll throw on some EDM. If I'm in a relaxed mood and I want to just chill at work that day, I'll throw on some country or some, you know, really low down rap music, stuff like that. It changes.
Now, who was the biggest supporter? Who's been your biggest supporter?
That's really hard to say. I've got, you know, a few family members, friends, people that I've met online on playing video games. I play a lot of video games. Yeah. A lot of people I've met online through that support. A bunch of people. Yeah. But I can't pinpoint a specific one who's like all about it.
Now, my biggest question is where do you find the time for the music? Because I know you're busy with church, busy with work, and so many other things in life. And I know music doesn't come quickly. So where do you find the time? Or do you just not sleep?
No, I sleep. I make sure I sleep. But I can't really tell you where I find the time. I just kind of make the time. So if I've got a few minutes, I'm hanging out at home, and something pops in my head, I sit down right then and just start on it. And it just kind of evolves throughout, you know, the next few weeks whenever I have the time to sit down. But most of the time, I just have to make it myself.
Now, what's the hardest part of the process?
The making music?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. I would say the hardest part is making it not sound like it's blocky or segmented. Finding transition points, making it flow really well. That's the hardest part. Because a lot of times it does sound really blocky, and you've got to put all these little frilly, cool sounding, you know, just sound effects to make it flow into the next part of the song and make it not sound like it's just, boom, you're there.
Now, how long is the process? Say that you have an idea, you know, this is where I want to end. How long does it take from start to where you say, okay, I got to walk away? That's how I get when I work on a project. I work until it's just like, okay, I've done all I can do.
Well, it's different for every song I make. So for my first song that I was like, okay, I'm ready to put this out because I've got my production skills good enough. The song, it had to be, I bought a really nice MacBook because I was like, you know what, I'm ready to get serious about it. So I bought a nice MacBook, bought some equipment, and I was like, I'm ready to go. As soon as I started that one song, I finished it in 4 days.
Yeah.
Painting Stars, I took probably about 2 weeks, spent a total of probably 20 to 30 hours on it.
Wow. Wow. Now, is most of that's the instrumentation, right?
Oh, no. The instrumentation is the quickest part.
That's the easy part?
Yeah. The hardest part is getting everything mixed correctly, because it's hard to say if you want the kick to stand out. It's hard to mix the rest of the track. Say if you have a bunch of synths, you want it to be loud and bulky, and you want it to cover the spectrum, but you also want the kick to stand out. So it's hard to get that mixed correctly to where either one isn't sounding weird or drowned out.
Mm-hmm. Now, if folks want to check out any of the music that you got, I know the Spotify, social media, where do folks catch up with you?
Instagram, it's just my last name, Maudy. Actually, Maudy with 3 Y's at the end.
Okay.
Because someone had already taken
it. Just because.
Yeah. I mean, somebody had already taken it, so I didn't really have that option. I think it was my sister who'd take it.
That's uncalled for.
But Facebook, I got a Facebook page. That's pretty much all I got, really.
All right. Check it out on Spotify. Again, the latest one, Painting Stars.
Yes.
Well, Maudy, it's great to visit with you. Glad we were able to work out the time, and we'll talk again real soon.
Thank you for having me.
Our next guest is author and inspirational leader, Rachel Hollis. We'll be talking about her new book. Rachel, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, Cameron, thank you so much for having me.
Now, Rachel talked about the writing, and when the pandemic hit and all the craziness came in, is that what inspired the new book?
Yeah, so I was actually in my first couple of weeks of quarantine back in March, and I was editing the book that was meant to come out this year. And typically my writing style is a lot of humor, very irreverent. And as I was editing this book, I was like, this doesn't feel right. This feels tone deaf. It feels like we're walking into a really hard year, and to bring something out that feels sort of silly, I worry that people would be disheartened by it. So I started asking myself, what would I want to write if I could write anything? And what would I want to say to people right now? And I began writing, and this was the book that came out. So it's all about, how do you navigate a crisis? What do you do with pain? What do you do with grief and trauma? Unfortunately, something that I walked through many times in my life. So that was the intention. I felt like I could offer some advice for anyone navigating a hard 2020.
And what was it that kind of tipped you off that to say that something was coming, if you will?
Well, to be honest with you, I've been a small business owner for almost 17 years, and I have taken a business through a recession before. So back in 2008 with the housing crisis, I navigated my company through that. And so really quickly, I could see that I didn't know what would happen in terms of healthcare, obviously, or what this would mean to us globally, but I knew I could see what this would do to the economy. And as sad as it is, I don't think we're anywhere near the ramifications of what this will do to the economy. So I just knew that that means people are going to hurt. They're going to lose their jobs. They're going to lose businesses. They're going to lose homes. And I'm saying this, and I sound so pessimistic, and you have to know I'm the most optimistic person in the whole world. But I also am honest with myself about what it is that's happening. And so I think it's possible to look at what really is and to acknowledge that it's hard, and then still reach for joy and still reach for positivity. And that's what this book is about.
I spoke to somebody early on in the pandemic, and one of the things that they equated to the way people were acting with all of the reactions that are going on, positive, negative, everything. One of the things that they talked about was how people seem to be grieving. Is that something that you've noticed in the feedback that you're getting from the viewers?
Absolutely. I think that people are grieving loss of the life that they had, right? I mean, and in many cases, maybe you are truly grieving someone that you've lost. But I think most people, even if they can't put their finger on it and call it that, they are grieving the fact that they could go, you know, to a football game, the fact that they could go out to dinner, the fact that they could go to church, the fact that they could do things without fear, that now, even as we navigate what it looks like to do those things, it still is coming with rules and regulations that didn't exist before. And so I think it's really healthy to process the grief and to allow yourself to feel sad about what once was, but also acknowledge and I say this with so much love in my heart, that there we're not going back to normal. I keep hearing people say that, like, oh, when it goes back to normal. We're not going back. We will accept what life is right now today, and I think that we'll continue to see it shift over the next year, and we'll learn a new normal, and we'll learn a new way to be. And that will be okay, too. But in order to accept that, I think you have to grieve the loss of what was.
And for you to, when you started out, what, if you look back now as to when you kind of got started, to see that the following that you've gotten and the lives that you've been able to impact, I mean, what does that make you feel on a personal level to know that you're empowering women, you're inspiring others to be better each day?
You know what's interesting about that, to be honest with you, is that when my career really started to explode, I couldn't even process that. And so to be truthful with you, I really don't think about the amount of people. Back before COVID, I would speak on stages a lot. I held big conferences for women, and I would do keynotes at other people's conferences. And my prayer before I got on stage every time was, God, give me just one. Give me just one person who hears something today that they need to hear. And so by focusing on one reader, one listener, one person, that has helped me to be more intentional and to be able to process everything that's happening. Because I think, I fear that if I thought about millions of people, that, I don't know, I worry that my ego would become involved or that I would do it for the wrong reason. So I really do just focus on just one person. So actually, Cameron, I love, you know, you said your wife was excited that we were sitting down today. So to me, I'm like, what a joy. Like, that makes my heart so happy.
And you've mentioned a couple times that how you try to be upbeat and lively and excited about things, but things are heavy right now. And how are you able to reach folks that are going through that heaviness and brighten their day? I mean, how challenging is that some days to forget about the things that you're going through to try to help other people as well?
Right. It is incredibly heavy right now for us as a global community. My family is going through something really hard. I'm going through a divorce and I have 4 kids, and that's incredibly painful. And so what I would say to people who are walking through a similar hard season is that you don't have to forget about the pain and you don't have to ignore it. I think that humans have this incredible ability to hold both joy and pain simultaneously. So I say, when you have a hard day, allow yourself to feel it. And then when you have a moment of levity, when your kid tells you a joke, when you see something funny, when you see a meme or you watch a funny movie, laugh with your whole heart and let yourself feel that joy too. Because I do think, having walked through grief many times, that the pain lessens. It doesn't go away completely. It doesn't go away ever. But it does lessen, and you get to a place where you are feeling more joy than you're feeling pain. And eventually, it becomes something that's sort of a dull ache, as opposed to this feeling that's ruling your life.
And again, that the new book, Didn't See That Coming. Rachel, I want to make sure and let our listeners know where they can find out more information about the book and also all the other social platforms you're on as well.
Yeah, so you can get the book anywhere books are sold. I always narrate my book, so if you like to listen, like you're listening on this show, you can grab that on Audible. And then my favorite, I'm on every social platform, but my favorite is Instagram, and I'm Ms. Rachel Hollis, M.S. Rachel Hollis.
All right. Well, Rachel, again, thank you for helping me get some brownie points today. Thoughts and prayers going out to you. We're going to make it through this, whatever that new normal is, right?
Absolutely. I believe that, Cameron.
Rachel, have a great rest of your week.
You too.
Again, you can find out more information on all the socials, Rachel Hollis, and find out about that book, Didn't See This Coming. Our next special guest is, one of my favorite bands of the 80s. I wore out tape after tape after tape and then CDs. Now able to just transfer from phone to phone and device to device with the music. We've got lead singer from the Christian and rock band Striper, Michael Sweet, with us. And Michael, it's great to visit with you again. I truly appreciate you taking some time.
Hey, buddy. Thank you, man. No worries. And it's an honor to be on. And pleasure to be talking to you.
And Michael, we talked a couple weeks ago talking about the new album and everything along with that. Wanted to give you an opportunity maybe to delve a little bit deeper into maybe the behind story of the new album and maybe what inspired the put together of the tracks, if you will.
Well, I mean, we wound up, I wrote the album in December and the guys came out in early January and stayed at the house. This is pre-pandemic. A lot of people think it was the album was put together entirely during the pandemic. It was not. And they came out, we rehearsed and we went in and started recording mid-January. And then that's when we started hearing about more cases in China and then the first cases in the U.S. And we just kept recording and doing our thing. And I mean, the way it works in the studio is we wake up in the morning, we all have breakfast, we all get showered because we stay at the studio. It's a house, big house. And, you know, we eat our breakfast and then we go out, we start around noontime. We start tracking and then we track on and off from noon to about 10 o'clock at night. And that's with a lunch break in the middle. And then after we stop, we go and have a dinner, a late night dinner, but a dinner nonetheless. And break bread together and hang out. And then we talk and laugh and stay up and wind up getting to bed about maybe midnight or 1 a.m. Wake up, we do it all over again. We do that for 2 weeks roughly. And we get about a song a day, the basic tracks for a song a day, because it's roughly around 12, 13 days for 12 or 13 songs. And we have a great time, man. And that comes through in the music as we're tracking. And then I wind up going home with the mixes, all the bed, the music bed, and I come home to my studio and I start tracking vocals. That usually take about a week off. Then I start tracking vocals at my studio, and then once that's done, we go back and mix. I usually always go back and mix in person. This time around, because of COVID, we mixed remotely, yeah. And it worked out great, man.
And is that kind of the recipe, if you will, for the previous albums as well that you went back to, or was it maybe you guys wanted to switch it up a little bit this time around?
No, it's the same recipe. The only thing that changed is mixing remotely. I had a high def feed and video feed, and I was here at home and Danny was in the studio. So that's the only thing that changed. And the other thing that changed is we had a different bass player, Perry. And we tracked at a different studio because Spirit House was located in Northampton for all the other albums, both Sweet Lynch albums, three solo albums, and then like six or seven Striper albums. They wound up selling that property and they moved to a different location in Longmeadow, Mass, and built a new studio. So it technically it was a new studio.
Now for you, what was the biggest challenge or is the biggest challenge now that during the pandemic with new music or have you found that to be maybe a bit of a blessing in disguise?
Well, I mean, it's both, you know, you refer to the new music. I missed part of the question, I believe. Can you repeat that one more time?
Yeah, all about the new music. I mean, with the pandemic, I mean, what has been the challenge or has been the blessing of doing it different this time around?
Gotcha. That's the part I missed, the pandemic. You know, there really weren't any challenges having recorded technically part of this album during the pandemic. When I came home to do vocals, we were full blown lockdown quarantine. So I recorded during the pandemic, but when I record vocals, I'm in lockdown mode anyway. I don't go anywhere. I stay home. There was really no difference for me, doing so during the pandemic. So, you know, other than, like I said, mixing remotely, that's the only thing that really felt different. But even that was good. And I think it actually worked out for the best because we were able to live with the mixes a little bit more so. But man, you know, we had a blast making an album. We gave it our all. We went in and we tried to outdo the last album, being Goddamn Evil. And I really believe that we did. I think this is our best album, certainly since our return. And so far, the vast majority of the fans seem to agree with that.
And for you, obviously, faith is huge for you. And to be able to put a little bit of faith, a little bit of inspiration into people's hearts, especially in a time when everything's so heavy, so dark. I mean, how cool is that for you on the personal side, Michael?
Oh, yeah. I mean, faith is everything to us. You know, that's where we base everything. It starts there. That's the foundation. It's very important. Some people think it's a gimmick and we just use it. And I always have to laugh at that, because if we were going to use something to help us make it as a band or be successful, it would never have been faith or the Bible. And that's the last thing in the world we would have used as a gimmick. So it's no gimmick. It's real. We love God with all of our hearts, and we want to inspire people to do the same. We want to help people with their lives and with their days and their worlds. And, you know, hopefully the music of Striper has done that.
And Michael, what was it like when the band was first making it onto the scene? I mean, how hard was it as a quote unquote Christian band to kind of make mainstream? Was that where there's how many doors were closed in your face because of the quote unquote Christian rock band?
Well, you know, we've gotten made fun of many times and been the brunt of many jokes over and over again. But in terms of, did it slow us down or keep us from achieving success? Not at all. I think despite it being a faithful Christian band, lyrically speaking, I think the music spoke for itself too, just as loudly. And when the label came to check us out, they wanted to sign us. There was no hesitation. You know, so, I mean, we held our own and still do to this day against any other band out there, because the music speaks for itself. You know, we go up on stage and play with 10 of our peers, 10 other bands from our genre, and there's no letdown in the set or in the festival show. We go out there and we hold our own and put on a show and get people into it, and people walk away saying, wow, okay, had no idea.
And Michael, how hard is it as a obviously being an inspiration, being a role model, to also be so genuine and open? I mean, does it make it hard for you to be that open for folks to see? Because I know as Christians, we get questioned all the time, no matter what we're doing. Do you find it hard opening up, I guess, is what I was trying to say?
No, not at all. I mean, I made a commitment to do just that, to always be an open book and be real, be honest. I think with that comes respect. You know, I'll never forget, I've met a few people without naming names over the years that, you know, I thought they were one way, and then you meet them in person and they're the complete opposite. And I just think to myself, well, they're obviously not real people. You know, because they've got two different things going on here, and it's very deceiving. I want to, good or bad, I want people to know who I am. That's why I post a picture of me having a cigar or drinking a bourbon, and people go, what? You know, but that's who I am. I'm not gonna lie to you, and then you find out in private that I really smoke a cigar or have a bourbon occasionally. I just want to be me and want to be real, and not let people down.
That's right. Now, Michael, I want to make sure all of the listeners know where to keep up with the new music, the new album that's out, and social media with all the dates that I know are eventually going to be out there as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the new album is available anywhere you can buy music, Amazon.com, Striper.com, whoever has music, whoever sells music, vinyl and CD. And of course, MP3, and then it's available for streaming on Spotify. It's out there. We got a video out right now, Doing to Others on YouTube. We're going to be releasing a new video called Divider very soon. And you know, we're moving right along, man. It's incredible. And here we are, 37 years later, still making a little noise.
And how cool is it to be able to reintroduce the vinyl to a new generation, Michael?
Oh, it's great. I mean, vinyl is very popular right now. Not like it was back in the 80s, but still, just the fact that it is a gift. We're very happy about that, that people want to actually purchase something and hold it and smell it and read it. And it's very cool.
And again, for more information, check out the website, follow them on all the socials, get the new album. And Michael, it is always a privilege to visit with you. I can't say thank you enough for your time. A huge fan. I could never hit those high notes like you, though.
Well, I have trouble hitting them these days, too, man. But it's a pleasure talking to you, too, buddy. Thanks for having me on, man.
All right, Michael. Talk to you real soon, sir.
God bless, buddy.
Again, thanks for joining us for this 23rd episode of Good Questions with Cameron Dole. If you ever have a comment, question, anything else you'd like to know, find me on Instagram, Twitter, and on our Facebook page at GQ with Cam. If you'd like to help out in the funding for this podcast, feel free to click the support tab and follow the instructions. And if you have a special guest that you'd like to bring on, send me an email, cameron@kwhw.com. We'll be back with episode 24 real soon.